Forum, if I could ask that you take your seats, we're going to go ahead and get started. I am Barbara Bigby. I am still the acting real estate commissioner. Oh, thank you. You guys didn't clap. This will become apparent why in a minute. If I could, I'd like to begin the introductions. To my right is our chief counsel, Wayne Bell. His right, we have our chief of enforcement, Bill Moran. Our chief auditor, Dan Sondry. The assistant commissioner for administration, licensing, and other related services, including IT, Steve Ellis. And joining us today is our newly appointed publications manager, Lisa Stratton. I'd also like to welcome Pat Neal, the former secretary. Well, while you're standing, you can just turn around and say hello. Former Secretary of Housing for Business, Transportation, and Housing. And I would also like to welcome and have you acknowledge members of our Oakland office who are joining us here today, our enforcement staff under the direction of Ed Haberer, and our audit staff under the direction of Mike Rivera over here in our cheering section. So if you guys would all stand. These are people you don't want to have come to your office unless it's a very friendly visit. Today's agenda and opening remarks are going to be somewhat brief, but what I wanted to do today was to give you kind of an update on what's going on at DRE, and I'm calling it the DRE headlines. Some things just take time. This notion can apply to almost anything from this week's Emmys to the appointment of a real estate commissioner or to the civil and criminal prosecutions for real estate-related violations. We at the DRE have referred several hundred cases to various local, state, and federal prosecutorial authorities. Time has continued to pass as we monitor the progress of over 200 of these cases that we consider to be the most high profile and collaborated with our law enforcement partners on many others. And with the passage of time, news reports of court cases, indictments, arrests, and convictions are beginning to hit the press across the state almost every day. Now is the time that DRE staff are being called upon to proffer testimony at civil, criminal, and grand jury proceedings on cases we have investigated. Our lawyers are also working with prosecutors as part of plea negotiations and with bail hearings to secure the surrender of real estate licenses as part of that proceedings. Our deputies, attorneys, and auditors are dedicated to taking the time to ensure that our administrative remedies for violations of the real estate law are coupled with the maximum criminal and or civil penalty available by law. Expanding our regulator interactions has been a time-consuming process, but time well spent. You need only browse the Attorney General's website to get a sense of how significant our interactions have been and continue to be in these desperate times. On their web pages dedicated to real estate fraud, you'll find a list of names that the AG's office has sued, and you will recognize many of those names because we've talked about them in these forums. Many are our respondents. The AG's website also has a link to a recent press conference, which she announced that her office has sued multiple entities who are accused of working together to defraud homeowners across the nation of deceptive marketing mass joinder lawsuits. DRE was invited to attend this conference, and Wayne Bell offered what I consider to be a stirring account within the minutes that he had available of the real estate and mortgage related fraud being perpetrated on Californians. This action by the Attorney General was the first taken by her mortgage fraud strike force following the DRE publication of a consumer alert authored by Wayne as to how these companies offer false hopes for extraordinary mortgage relief by having homeowners pay up front to join class action suits against mortgage lenders. Unlicensed real estate scams are a sign of the times, and DRE has been actively investigating all unlicensed activity complaints. As an example, last week, licensing was called upon to testify by special invitation that we called a subpoena. In a criminal case brought after a year after we had issued a DNR for unlicensed activities and advance fee violations. We thought we were there solely to certify that the defendant was unlicensed. However, once the licensing manager arrived and was on the stand, he was able to convey to the jury not only that the defendant was not properly licensed, but what that meant in terms of the charges that were filed against him. He was also able to describe in his testimony the department's enforcement and investigative efforts, as well as our participation on the particular investigation that led to the grand jury indictment. The defense was unable to rattle the DRE witness or poke holes in the testimony. In fact, he took the time to correct the defense on some of the provisions of the real estate law. I'm told he sat there in the witness stand with his law book in hand and pointed her in the right direction when she needed direction. As a result, the jury convicted the unlicensed defendant of one felony count of grand theft and two misdemeanors for acting without a real estate license and advance fee agreement violations. This is a bit unusual in that we don't often see acting without a license in a criminal charge or conviction, but we think it is about time. Sentencing for this individual will be held on November 21st, and it is expected Mr. Unlicensed will be doing time, probably 6 to 8 years, in state prison, since this is not his first brush with the law. Oregon Real Estate Commissioner Gene Bentley and I are exploring the creation of a Western States Regulator Consortium through which we can keep each other alerted to real estate scammers that slip back and forth across our state borders. He obviously doesn't want our 5,000 active investigations just poured into his email inbox, so we'll be working together to identify multi-state risk patterns so that we can target misconduct, share information on pertinent investigations, and identify the expanse of victims and losses. And the reason we're doing that is because that is key in getting the maximum criminal sentence or civil award. Time will tell how successful this new collaboration will be. And for the first time in almost 3 years, DRE was invited to participate in upfront development meetings on two notable new subdivision projects, indicating to us there might be a glimmer of new life coming from the housing and building industry. Large-scale new development has been virtually non-existent since the market downturn, and this renewed surge may be happening just in the nick of time. We are also expanding access to our information by keeping up with the times. By the end of the month, you'll be able to follow us on Facebook, where we intend to publish our consumer alerts, press releases, administrative actions that we have taken, and our consumer brochures, just as we have provided the sampling for you here today. Lastly, we will be expanding our Certified Sites program. This program exists on our website, and it assists commercial and industrial business select, plan, and develop new or existing sites. We intend to add several new site categories, which are readily available for project development or initiation in the use of the shortest period of time. It is the right time to help draw business back into these available locations, warehouses, and buildings throughout California, which will in turn have a positive impact on the economy and housing in the adjacent neighborhoods. So with that, it's time for the operations report. That would be me as chief deputy. I'm still here, too. This first slide provides the same details as in your handouts as to the revenue, net expenditures, and reserve balances for the fiscal year 2010-11. Revenue for the year totaled $46.1 million, averaging $3.8 million per month, while expenditures totaled $42.9 million and averaged $3.6 million per month. Reserve balances have been relatively constant during the year, beginning at 29.3 in July and ending at 30.1 at the end of the fiscal year. Now, in looking at the monthly expenditures for this year, you will note that the first 3 months, we spent under $2 million each month. That's because there was no state budget at that time, and the only thing we could do was pay salaries. We could not even buy pencils. Conversely, if you look at June, the total net expenditures is far more than any other month. Let me remind you that it is during June that we renew maintenance contracts for the forthcoming year and that we stockpile supplies because we don't expect to have a state budget on July 1st anymore. This year, we also accrued, all of the recovery fund claims that were filed in the year 2010. 35% of that $7.9 million represents recovery fund claims that are pending. If those recovery fund claims are not paid at the full amount or not paid at all, that money will revert back to the reserves. So let's take a look at the summary comparison of the past two fiscal years. Revenue increased by 6%. This is mainly attributable to the MLO license endorsement fees. Net expenditures increased by 10%. This is mainly attributable to the staff that process the MLO licenses and the increase in the recovery fund. And DRE reserves increased by 12%. DRE reserves will continue to grow little by little, month by month, until we're fully staffed to handle all of the MLO activities. As to the licensing workload, all I can say is everything's down. Salesperson exam applications were down by 12%, with brokers down by 14%. Accordingly, the number of original licenses issued were down by 5% for salespersons and 10% for brokers. Renewals. Now, while we talk about renewals in terms of the percentage of those eligible to renew that actually do renew, it remained constant at 60% over those 2 years for salespeople, but you will note that there was a 10% decline in the actual number of renewals filed. That is because we are still dealing with the surge of licensees from the 5, 6, 7 area, and the comparison is still kind of going like this, and then be another 4 years and it'll go like this, and when the last 4 years it'll kind of even out. The percentage of broker licenses up for renewal was off by 1% from 78% to 77% in 10-11, and the actual number of renewal licenses dropped by 5%. The result is that the license population has dropped every month an average of 7% in fiscal year 2010-11. Now, as we make our fiscal year comparisons of the license population, you will see that for the first time we've actually in fiscal year 10-11 dropped below what we had in 4-5. The peak was in November of 2007. We have been declining ever since. Today, the number of licenses is 440,551. Now, when we hit 440,000, we began to stutter a little bit back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So I don't know how much further down it's going to go, but it's still kind of stuttering like this. We haven't seen that before. It's always been a constant decline. The enforcement activities, our program continues to concentrate on consumer protection and investigating complaints. When we compare the two fiscal years, we find that with the continuing low numbers of original license applications, background checks, which could lead to license denials, are down by 121. The percentage of outright denials, however, remains pretty consistent between the 2 years at 63%. The disciplinary action shows an increase of 36. In 2010-11, the department took more and tougher enforcement actions than in previous years. Of the 925 total disciplinary actions taken in the past fiscal year, 801 represent revocations and license surrenders, roughly 87% of those actions. Those people are out of business. DNRs increased by 40 as unlicensed fraud continues to thrive. Investigative audits dropped by 37 as these audits grow increasingly more comprehensive and labor intensive. However, we also perform 255 random and follow-up audits on high-risk business operations, representing an increase of 200 over the prior fiscal year. And I'm pleased to report that we are still issuing bar orders, 24 bar orders for 10-11, banning the worst of the worst from all real estate and related business activities. In fact, I signed one just this week on an individual who had participated in the operation of a real estate deed of trust Ponzi scheme, which resulted in over $4 million in losses to 69 victims. As to subdivision activities, well, we were really hoping that we'd have a stronger gain this year than last, but that really didn't happen. Despite some stutters and starts, the bottom line is that we ended up pretty much in the same spot as the prior year, with a significant exception of amended applications. Fewer projects are now being phased than in the prior year, and that means to us that there will be fewer broken projects and fewer projects going into bankruptcy, and perhaps more new development as I described earlier. And last but certainly not least, today is a very significant day. DRE is proud to announce that we have opened our newest exam center in the Los Angeles area, and today is the first day that we have been conducting electronic exams in that facility quite successfully. Thank you. And right now, people are suffering through the second half of their the second session of the salesperson exams are underway. We had our first pass on the electronic exam at about 9 o'clock this morning. We will next move on to San Diego, which is slated to open its exam center by the end of the calendar year. Okay, my time has come to an end, and I want to thank you for your attention, and I am pleased to welcome our Chief Counsel, Wayne Bell.
Thank you, Barbara, and good afternoon. I'm very delighted to be here in beautiful San Jose with all of you. Unlike my colleagues who are technologically proficient, they're going to have slides and videos and things like that. This is my only slide. The topic of my three-hour presentation, I just want to see if anyone was listening. The topic of my presentation is Fraud, the Beat Goes On. And what I plan to share with you are the general types of fraud we're seeing at the department, our understanding of those who are involved in the fraud, committing the scams, some of the efforts that we have undertaken to combat that, as well as what we, and that's the Department of Real Estate, Carr, and you, can do to help focus on the fraud and help end it. And I hope to do that without boring you to death. As you know, since 2008, we've seen a cascade, a tsunami, a flood of fraud throughout the state of California. And mostly in the area of foreclosure rescue and purported mortgage relief, but the schemes aren't related to that at all. According to a recent FBI report, California has the highest number of mortgage and real estate fraud cases. The deceit comes in a variety of flavors, and there's absolutely no shortage of ingenuity. There are various levels of sophistication. Some of the fraud is very lowbrow, unsophisticated, and some is very complex and extremely complicated. In most, but far from all of the cases that we've seen, since 2008, the fraudsters have taken advantage of California homeowners who are in foreclosure, in danger of or on the road to foreclosure, and those who are underwater with their mortgages and who are unable to refinance, and who are desperate, vulnerable, scared, and unsophisticated in the area of real estate and mortgage finance. And while we at the DRE are investigating thousands of cases of fraud, and I have to tell you, Bill Moran's group has, I want to say, Bill, maybe about 5,600 open investigations, and those over 3,000 are transactional matters, which look like there may be fraud involved. So we have thousands of cases. Federal prosecutors, state prosecutors, local prosecutors have thousands of cases. But I have a suspicion that much of the fraud hasn't even been uncovered yet, and much of it hasn't been reported. And I'm thinking this because we know there's underreporting by banks. We know that some folks have said that they're too embarrassed to report the fraud. Others just don't know where to report. We participate in a number of meetings, and we talk with folks, and they say, well, someone ripped me off, but I didn't know where to go. I called my police department, I called my senator, I called my council person. Some folks have the wherewithal to get to us. They talk with us, they file the report, and then we share the information. But some people are actually being turned away by police departments and others who just don't know where to go. We also know that there's affinity fraud, and that's where a particular group, whether it's ethnic or religious or whatever group it is, they take advantage of their members of their own group. And oftentimes folks who have been victimized in the affinity fraud don't want to report because they're turning someone in who's like them, and they're feeling they're feeling like they don't want to do that. Then other folks have what is known in the law as unclean hands. They may not have been entirely forthright in their mortgage application. They might have involved themselves in some small oversight, and so they're not going to report the fraud there. And then in other cases, we believe the fraud is just too complex to have been discovered yet. The deceit is only limited by the creativity of those who are committing it and those who are being victimized by it. The other thing that should come as no surprise to you is that real estate scams adapt to changing times. In the housing boom, we saw different types of fraud than we have seen during the housing bust. But some of the bad players were involved before the bust are now engaged in the fraud after the bust. And in both, we have seen unsophisticated folks taken advantage of, lenders being defrauded, together with the use of false appraisals, false documentation, fraudulent broker price opinions or broker opinions of value, and undisclosed fees and compensation. The current scams include, but they're in no way limited to, deed transfer, rent skimming, and equity stripping scams, forged deeds and other documents, submittal of false information to lenders, power of attorney abuses, reverse mortgage ripoffs, loan modification, and forensic audit scams. And we saw for a while a real slowdown in loan modification fraud, and that's because there was a Senate bill known as Senate Bill 94, and it said that no one could take advance fees for loan modification services before they performed the work that they promised to perform. But what we're seeing in some areas of the state, especially low-income minority areas, is advertisements in a non-English format, and people are paying advance fees, some of them significant advance fees. Then we're seeing property flipping and flops, and as you know, those can be lawful. There's nothing wrong with them as long as there's disclosure and everybody knows what's going on. But what we're seeing is a number of them being performed by unlicensed people and entities, the concealment of or hidden relationships, and intentional failures to disclose information to lenders. We're also seeing hidden payments outside of escrow, unlawful advance fee scams of all sorts, where people are paying up to $10,000 for assistance, embezzlement, conversion, and commingling, and we're seeing this, unfortunately, in some property management cases that we have. We're seeing broker-controlled escrow fraud, timeshare sales advance fee fraud, and much, much more. I thought I'd just bring a sampling of 2 days' worth of headlines that were provided to me. And it's pretty stark if you just listen to the headlines. Here's real estate fraudsters get creative. Two arrested in Fontana for foreclosure fraud. Sacramento man pleads in loan modification fraud case. Two plead guilty to Sacramento area mortgage fraud. Riverside fights real estate fraud. Glendale real estate agent steals brother's property. Seal Beach real estate agent arrested. Alleged mastermind in Los Angeles real estate fraud ring arrested. Ken and Katie radio hosts arrested in real estate fraud. I don't know who they are, but I thought that was interesting. But the sad thing is, and you'll note that this is happening all over the state. It's happening consistently, and it continues to happen. So who's committing the fraud? I ask this question of every prosecutor I can talk with when they get the background information on the people that they're pursuing in their investigations and their prosecutions. And I want to make certain that I'm really adamant here, and I underscore this. Most of the fraud is being committed by unlicensed people and unlicensed companies. And many of those folks have prior criminal records. They are, I'm told, the typical unscrupulous rogue cons and crooks who prey on those in financial distress. As a side note, on the spectrum of bad conduct, we'll see an isolated incident all the way to sophisticated rings and organized groups that operate throughout California and in other states as well. But sadly, in addition to the unlicensed folks, we're also seeing cases where real estate licensees are involved, sometimes knowingly and willingly, sometimes unknowingly and maybe unwillingly. And we're also seeing lawyers, accountants, appraisers, and other professionals involved as well. Now, I want to shift to the department's efforts. Barbara mentioned before some of the things that we've done. I want to highlight some of those and tell you some other stuff that we've done too. As the state's real estate licensing, regulatory, and enforcement agency, we've been deeply involved in shining the light on the fraud and working to prosecute it as well. To that end, we have done a multitude of things, some of which Barbara mentioned before, and they include reaching out to and working with federal, state, and local prosecutors. We're on task forces up and down the state with the FBI, the U.S. Attorney, HUD, the Federal Trade Commission, city attorneys, district attorneys. We work closely with the state bar and others. And what we're trying to do is help stamp out the fraud so that your industry can get back to doing what it does. And that's helping people buy, sell, and finance homes. As Barbara noted in her presentation, I had the privilege recently of speaking at the Attorney General's press conference, where it was noted that a lawsuit was brought against a number of lawyers and others in connection with mortgage fraud. And the trouble homeowners there were lured in by advertisements that promised all sorts of benefits, and those benefits were never to accrue. At the conference, I argued, and I continue to argue to everyone I speak with about this, that real justice demands a concerted and cooperative action among and between all public sector agencies, quick and firm justice, and appropriate penalties, including prison time for the worst, so that the frauds and swindlers are removed from the street. Such a coordinated and cooperative effort to get out in front of the fraud, to be proactive, is absolutely crucial, since there are a lot more bad players, a lot more bad folks out there than there are government investigators and lawyers. And just to give you some sense, and I know we haven't talked about this all that much, just to give you some sense of the size of our department versus the folks we're looking at. As I mentioned before, Bill has about 5,600 open investigations, about 3,300 possible fraud complaints. We have 22 lawyers statewide. That's in Los Angeles and Sacramento. Of those, only 18 do administrative prosecutions. Bill has about 60 general investigators. He's borrowed some from our subdivisions unit. Dan has about 31 auditors. And all of us are up against the cascade of these cases coming in, and they continue to come in each and every day. In September of 2009, we created and filled a position at the department called Law Enforcement Coordinator, and I know Joe Carrillo has been here before and spoken with you, and his job is to marshal our efforts and to focus our attention on our law enforcement outreach effort to try to help other agencies and us figure out how we can best attack and confront and get rid of the fraud that we're seeing in the marketplace. Our efforts and outreach to the other public and law enforcement entities are ongoing, and they include working with the state bar. In October 2008, we first met with the state bar. In 2009, we did trainings for them, and they've been a great public service partner. They've taken on a number of lawyers. They have thousands of investigations, and they've taken licenses away of a number of lawyers who have been involved in real estate and mortgage fraud schemes. We also had the opportunity to work with Jerry Brown when he was Attorney General to help focus on loan modification fraud. His office has been great in working with us. They've got a number of cases teed up for criminal prosecution, and we're working with his successor as well. In June 2010, Jeff Davy and I participated in a press conference done by Benjamin Wagner in Sacramento. That's the Eastern District of California. And during the press conference, in which he announced the prosecution of 40 people who are involved in real estate and mortgage fraud, he told us that the Department of Real Estate are really his eyes and ears on the ground. And one of the things that we have become, and people have looked at us as being, is their feeder pool and their source of expertise. Because at the department, we have people who understand how transactions work, and they work very well in trying to unwind transactions, focus on them, and help criminal and civil prosecutors, as Barbara noted before. We have also, in addition to offering up our human resources at the department, we have provided a training to our investigators, our auditors, and our lawyers. And we call it Prop 115 training. And let me explain what this means. Typically, when a criminal case is brought, especially a felony case, there is a preliminary hearing, at which time there is a decision made by the judge as to whether there's probable cause to move forward with the hearing. In the past, because our folks were not trained as Prop 115 investigators, if a felony criminal matter was filed, the prosecutor would have to have their own staff review everything that our staff did in order to testify at a preliminary hearing. But because our staff has now been trained, they can go down to these preliminary hearings and testify on a hearsay basis. They can explain exactly what they did, who they spoke with, what they learned, and then the judge can make the determination as to whether there's probable cause to move forward. And because of that, we're seeing prosecutions moving forward more quickly, and we're seeing better results. And I believe, Barbara, I'm not certain, but I was told yesterday, I think, that we've had about 15 people testify at these hearings so far. So that's a big effort on behalf of the department. The other thing that we've done, and I'm proud to have been a part of this, and everybody at this table has too, is we've really cranked up our consumer awareness effort. We've done press releases, we've done consumer alerts, we've done PSAs, we participated in PSAs, and we've done these in English and Spanish and other languages. We participated in radio programs, television programs, we've talked with reporters, because the effort is absolutely necessary to make certain that the real estate industry is not inundated with these folks who just continue to victimize Californians. In our Los Angeles office, we created a special bilingual outreach and advocacy team. And that's because we have a profound and serious recognition that so much of the fraud that's taking place throughout California is in the Spanish language. Some of the ads have amazing hyperbole, and many of the victims are Latinos. And so we have a special group in Los Angeles that focuses on the Latino population. We've created a speakers bureau. We have an internal real estate mortgage fraud task force that focuses on this issue. And we are focusing on the cases that yield the highest results. As Barbara noted, we're doing more DNRs than we've ever done before. The DNRs are more comprehensible. They're more usable, meaningful, and relevant than ever before. In the past, we would have citations to code sections, and some of the district attorneys would say, we're not quite certain what those mean. And so now we're trying to be much more robust, much clearer in what we tell the DAs so that they know this is unlicensed activity. We have people who are engaged in real estate-related work that should have licenses, and they don't. And so we're hoping to see many more prosecutions like the one that Barbara mentioned. Now, turning to the enforcement numbers, Barbara mentioned some of the numbers, but I want to highlight something else. We have seen the numbers of cases increase each and every year. In addition, to what Barbara noted about the revocations, I wanted to go into a little of the detail. In fiscal year 2010 to 2011, we revoked 564 real estate licenses, received a voluntary surrender of 115 real estate licenses, revoked another 122 with the right to a restricted license. In the area of foreclosure, rescue, and loan modification fraud, we issued hundreds of desist and refrain orders against individuals and well over 100 accusations against real estate licensees. Plus, we have filed and served a number of bar orders, and those numbers keep growing. While the department's efforts have been extensive and aggressive, and for all the progress we have made, real estate and mortgage fraud in the state continues to thrive, grow, and evolve. And while everyone says the business in the recession is bad, I can tell you the fraud business has not been bad. And we want to make certain that's turned around. So what can we do together? I believe that by working together, Carr, the Department of Real Estate, and each of you working with us can help to ferret out, expose, and help to prosecute the fraud. With your knowledge, expertise, wisdom, and hands-on knowledge and experience, you can join with us as the eyes and ears on the ground. The challenge is large, but together, through reporting and the dissemination and sharing of information, we can help to cleanse the real estate industry, that noble industry in which you work, of the unlicensed, the illegitimate, the criminals, and the flagrant violators of the real estate law. Thank you for inviting me here today and for all that you do. Next speaker is William Moran, my colleague, who's in charge of our enforcement program.
I think I'm locked here. There we go. Okay, well, good afternoon to all of you. Today I'm going to present actually three cases, two of which occurred right here in the San Jose area and were investigated by our Oakland staff. The first case is representative of the kind of activity that has actually led to the economic conditions that we all face today, which was largely caused by faulty lending practices and those who were willing to take advantage of them. The case involved a number of respondents, but the most prominent in there was Vision Quest, Inc., who actually did business under the fictitious business name of Century 21 Sucasa, Mariposa Mortgage, which was their wholly controlled mortgage company, and the designated officer of all of it was a gentleman by the name of Bick Foe. We also had eight of their salespeople involved in an action that we ultimately took. Now, the respondents in this case engaged in a scheme to defraud lenders, and seemingly everyone employed at these companies participated in the fraud. It is, after all, relatively easy to sell real estate and generate fees when you don't have to concern yourself with pesky little details like finding legitimate qualified purchasers and helping them find the homes they want. Instead, all this group needed were homes that were listed on the market. As was often the case, we had a real estate broker who employed salespeople that utilized straw buyers to purchase property, falsifying income and employment information, as well as the buyer's intention to occupy the properties. All that the straw buyers needed was a good FICO score. In one example, they sold four properties simultaneously to a straw buyer, claiming that she was a web designer earning $12,500 a month. Also claiming that she intended to occupy the properties, all four of which she was buying at the same time. In truth, she was employed at the local school district, and they were able to arrange over $2 million in loans for this individual, all of which went into default shortly after escrows closed. With a second buyer, who was in fact a telemarketer employed by Vision Quest, they represented that he was earning $14,000 a month working for Neary Transportation. The salesperson involved in the transaction, incidentally, his last name was Neary. In fact, He was working on a straight commission basis for Vision Quest, and he had just started, and up to that date hadn't earned anything. He was paid $2,500 for the use of his credit in this transaction. And on it went, with dozens of straw buyers, all of the properties going down to default, and the straw buyers ended up finding their credit ruined. So as is usually the case, when you're dealing with someone who is willing to defraud a lender, you'd better take cover, because chances are that they're willing to defraud you as well. And the individuals who acted as straw buyers in these transactions learn that lesson. They also, at these companies, routinely had cash kickback at the close of escrow, usually under the guise that the monies were being paid to a handyman to make repairs on the property. In the last example, they had $20,000 kicked back to the wife of one of the licensees who was involved in the transaction. Now, they, of course, brokered all of their loans through their own company, Mariposa Mortgage, and they brokered them to lenders who were basically asleep, performed no underwriting or review procedures, knowing that they were simply going to sell the loans and pass them off to another institution. Those in the secondary market didn't ask any questions and simply packaged the loans and then sold them to investors. In essence, everyone involved was greedy. Now, being a full-service operation, as they were, they collected fees on every end of the transaction, from the commission on the sale to the loan origination fee and processing fees, followed by additional cash back at the close of escrow. In one example, which was a $480,000 transaction, they collected $14,400 as a real estate commission, charged on the residential side an additional $525, which they called a transaction fee, a $6,000 loan origination fee, $995 processing fee, an $1,800 yield spread premium, a $500 appraisal fee, and then received $20,000 cash back at the close of escrow for a total of almost $45,000. Again, all of the properties that they sold immediately went into foreclosure. And as Wayne pointed out earlier, where they did have actual buyers, they were very active in the Spanish-speaking community and placed them into loans that they couldn't possibly afford and misrepresented the terms of those loans. So the DRE took action in this case, which resulted in the revocation of multiple licenses: Vision Quest Inc., Mariposa Mortgage, Big Foe, and eight of their salespeople. Now, obviously, mere license discipline in these cases is insufficient for the type of fraudulent activity that took place. And there needs to be more severe consequences, and Wayne covered a lot of that. To date, there has been one prosecution of a salesperson in this firm. Her name was Gloria Alvarez, and she was convicted on a felony charge for conspiracy to commit crimes, and she's currently in jail. Also, in a case of motherly love, she included her own son, Ricardo Alvarez, in the scheme. He was unlicensed, but he was also sentenced to a term in jail. It amazes me how many of these individuals include their own family members in their schemes. And basically what it says is they don't think that they will ever get caught. Now, this particular case, and those of you who may be familiar with it, did take longer than usual to complete. And the problem that we had was that there are rules of evidence that we need to comply with when we bring a case to an administrative hearing. And this includes having qualified individuals from the institutions who were defrauded appear at the hearing, validate documents, and provide testimony. In this case, and probably not surprisingly, most of them were mortgage bankers, and they all had gone out of business. It probably has something to do with their lending practices. And their files were then dispersed to unknown locations. Essentially, there was no one left at these companies to ask. We had no custodian of records who could validate the loan files that we obtained earlier in our investigation. So without this information, all we really had was a lot of interesting information that was inadmissible at an administrative hearing. But eventually, with a lot of diligent work on the part of our staff and our attorney who handled the case, we were able to track down the prior staff and the files, and we were able to proceed to hearing. Following the revocation of Big Foe's license, incidentally, we also issued a bar order against him, barring him from any position of employment with a real estate brokerage, escrow company, title company, or lender. That's not only as a licensee, but that's any position of employment. And it is my understanding that not too long ago, he was attempting to start up another company, and this bar order should serve as notice that he's not to be involved in any type of real estate business. The second case that I'm going to present today is sort of the result of the market conditions I discussed earlier, and also has a lot in common with Wayne's presentation. Every now and then we come across a bad apple who seemingly just won't go away. This particular case involved an unlicensed individual by the name of Carl Renowitzki, who does business in the San Jose area under the name of United Investments, and he seems to pop up in bad markets to take advantage of distressed homeowners. Dating all the way back to 1998, he was involved in a series of at least 10 transactions. His basic scheme was to post a sign around various neighborhoods just saying, "We buy property," with a phone number, and then wait for calls. When he was contacted by distressed homeowners, he would offer to save the homeowner's credit and purchase the property for $1 and then take over the underlying loan payments, promising a quick sale. The funny thing about this is none of the homeowners ever even received a dollar. Once the agreement was executed and the owners would move out, Renowitzki would then simply rent the properties out, skimming the rents while making no payments on the underlying loans and ruining the one thing that the sellers wanted to save, which was their credit. The department issued a desist and refrain order to him in 1999 and had considerable contact with the DA's office at that time. However, no prosecution took place. Fast forward 10 years, and we're in the next down market. And who pops up again but Carl Renowitzki, again with the same old story, doing business under the name of United Investments. He would contact distressed homeowners, offering to save their credit by negotiating a short sale, and then sweetening the transaction by offering to let them rent to own the properties after he did so. I have a video here that tells the story of a couple of the homeowners who got involved with him.
Dozens of distressed Bay Area homeowners say they've been lured into signing away their homes to a company offering to help them. A seven-month, Seven on Your Side investigation has uncovered what happens to many of these homeowners after they sign on the dotted line. And Michael Finney is here with the story. Michael, this is really terrible.
Yeah, it is. This is really a story of just how vulnerable homeowners can become when they're facing foreclosure. Many of these folks have not only signed away their homes, they actually paid a company to take it. Arnell Reyes remembers the day he signed over the deed to his house to United Investments of Hayward. His wife had just lost her job, and the couple was facing the foreclosure of their home in Bay Point.
I couldn't afford the mortgage plus the other bills that we had at that point, so I just wanted to save my credit.
United Investments charged Reyes $2,000 to take possession of his home. He claims the company told him it had a potential buyer and could do a short sale. The contract made no guarantees a foreclosure could be prevented, but Reyes figured by signing up, he could save his credit, if not his house.
They said if they couldn't save it, they would foreclose under their name and not our name.
This is Lorenzo Lawson. He answered an ad on Craigslist from United Investments offering to rent out the Reyes home. Lawson says the company told him he might eventually be able to buy it.
If they want to have me stay there, maybe I could rent to own.
He paid $2,000 to United Investments before moving in, and before he knew it, he found a foreclosure notice on his door. Lawson was forced to leave the home, and the lender foreclosed on the Reyes property. Reyes says
he felt deceived.
They said on the website or on the interview that we had at their office that they would actually, you know, help us save our credit, and they would foreclose on them instead of us, but it didn't work out that way.
It didn't work out that way for a lot of others, too. We checked public records. United Investments, also known as CAA International, has taken over the deeds of 15 properties since 2008 in Contra Costa County alone. 9 of the homes have already been foreclosed. Foreclosures are pending on 5 of the remaining 6 properties. Attorney General Jerry Brown wouldn't talk about this case, but says these types of schemes are suspect.
Actually getting people to sign over their title out of some story that the scam artist tells the homeowner, I don't know how prevalent it is, but if we find it, we'll certainly turn it over to the local district attorney for prosecution.
We went to the offices of United Investments for some answers. The company's president is Carl Renowitzki, the man in this photo, and the man both Reyes and Lawson say they dealt with. We showed up at his office several times in an attempt to see Renowitzki. Oh, you locked the door. Hey, I'm Michael Finney from Channel 7. Unlock the door and we can talk. Renowitzki was nowhere to be found, but we did find this. A cease and desist order against Renowitzki in 1999. From the State Department of Real Estate. The order accused him of operating without a license. The Department of Real Estate said he was involved in at least 10 real estate transactions at the time. We found the records for 5 of those transactions, and once again, United Investments talked homeowners into signing over the deeds of their homes. 4 of the 5 transactions we tracked ended in foreclosure. The 5th house belonged to the Johnsons of Richmond. They avoided foreclosure, but were surprised when they found out United Investments wasn't paying off their mortgage.
They were collecting the rent from the tenant, and half the time they were not making the mortgage payment.
The name on United Investments' door now says Property Group. A spokesman told us by phone that United Investments is no longer in business, but when it was, everything was fully disclosed to its clients.
Now, here's some irony. We found 2 homes listed in Renowitzki's name. Both are in foreclosure. The Alameda County District Attorney's Office has launched an investigation into United Investments. So if you've had any dealings with the company, let me know about it. Email me by going to abc7news.com and clicking on 7 on your side.
And I know you'll follow up on the District Attorney's investigation.
Absolutely.
All right, Michael, thanks very much.
Well, inasmuch as Mr. Renowitzki is unlicensed, our only administrative remedy was to issue another desist and refrain order to him, which we did in December of 2010. And actually, we haven't heard from him since. But this case is a classic example of why support from criminal prosecutors is essential to getting individuals such as this off of the streets. Moving into my next topic, I want to discuss short sale transactions a little, and some of this I've gone over with you in the past. But again, we're continuing to see the same issues in the area of short sales. Number one, we're seeing unlicensed short sale negotiators, which is in some cases are in fact real estate salespeople who have set up their own unlicensed corporations or LLCs in order to collect additional fees and transactions. And often this is done outside of their employing broker. We have accusations pending against several of them at this time. So remember that short sale negotiation requires a real estate license, and even the act of paying an unlicensed individual or corporation is prohibited under Section 10137 of the Business and Professions Code. So when you are involved with a short sale negotiator, I would ask all of you to please check at least to make sure that they are licensed. Second area we continue to see is the collection of advance fees in this area. In many cases, short sale negotiators collect advance fees for their services, and even if they are licensed, there are other provisions in the real estate law that they need to comply with in order to legally collect advance fees. First, they need to have an advance fee agreement on file with the Department of Real Estate. And I can tell you, as of right now, we have none. Secondly, the advance fees that are collected need to be handled as trust funds. So they need to be placed in a trust account. They need to be properly accounted for with records and the types of things that Dan Sandry will be looking at when he goes out to these offices. And then also, when they actually disperse the funds from the trust account, they need to give an accounting to the principals who are involved as to how much was dispersed and what it was for. And to make their car payment doesn't count. Another area that we're seeing in the area of short sales is property flips and double escrows. This is simply, again, usually it's just another form of lender fraud. And there's a lot of this occurring all over the country. And I'm going to cover a specific case of that in a minute. Another area is making hidden payments. Making payments to the seller from the buyer in order to get into a transaction, or making payments to a short sale negotiator or a junior lien holder without the knowledge of the lender and without reflecting those monies on the HUD-1 at the close of escrow. In one example, we had a real estate broker who was involved in a transaction where there was a $7,000 second trust deed recorded against the property. As a condition of agreeing to a short sale, the lender specified that the holder of the second was to receive no more than $2,000 on that note. Our broker's solution was to have the buyer pay $5,000 to the junior lien holder outside of escrow. We filed an accusation against this broker, and she ultimately voluntarily surrendered her license. Her comment was rather interesting. She said she thought it was standard practice to do this. Moving on to, you know, probably one of the biggest areas that we see that are certainly major fraud areas is property flips or flops, however you wish to term them. And they're taking place all over the country. And again, this is usually just a scheme to defraud lenders. They involve falsified broker price opinions, usually lowballing the actual value of the property. They use straw buyers in the initial purchase of a transaction with flash funding to fuel the deal. They fail to advise lenders that a higher offer actually exists, and they double escrow the property for a quick turnaround to a legitimate buyer for a quick profit. In a recent case that has occurred in the Los Angeles area, we had a company that put together hundreds of transactions in just this manner. Again, they controlled every aspect of the transaction in that they had a real estate broker corporation with its own escrow division. They also owned a corporate escrow company. It was licensed through the Department of Corporations. And all of it was under the complete control of an unlicensed individual by the name of Diana Lopez. And what they would do is they purchased property from distressed sellers at artificially low prices, supported by falsified broker price opinions. They also seemingly had some inside employees at the bank who would kind of brush these cases, these transactions through. They would then use straw buyers and flash funding from a group based in the state of Washington to fund the initial purchase, and then they would sell the properties to an ultimate purchaser. Now, remember what I said earlier, that when you're dealing with someone who is willing to defraud a lender, you'd better take cover, because chances are they're willing to defraud you as well. This is the lesson the flash funder ultimately learned. Everything went along fine in these transactions for a period of about a year. When flash funds were drawn on properties towards the latter part of 2010, they were absconded with, and they were not used to pay off the underlying encumbrances on the property. Over a short period of time, the flash funding source was out about $12 million. Now, the properties that were involved in these transactions were still sold to buyers who put large deposits totaling about $1.7 million that we know of, and they never received title to those properties. Now, obviously, we've revoked the license of this company, and there's a criminal investigation pending. Inasmuch as the company is still on title to a large number of properties, they have been forced into involuntary bankruptcy by one of the buyers. But you know, I would have to say that the chances of everyone being made whole in this is virtually zero. Now, in order to approach the issues that we're seeing in the marketplace, you know, our strategies, we need to combat these problems from every aspect. We need full administrative prosecution. We also need to have full criminal and civil prosecution, because you know, a lot of these individuals, if you're making $12 million, don't really care that much about a real estate license. So as Wayne described in his presentation, we've really stepped up our efforts recently to become more relevant and more of a driving force to get criminal prosecutions in the cases that we're seeing. And lastly, again, your role in this, you know, we really encourage all of you to become aware of these issues and to be our eyes and ears out there. We at the Department of Real Estate are small in number, and it's a big state. But through all of your associations and all of the licensees that are that work under you in those associations, you cover the state. So we ask that you help us spread the word and that you report to us any issue that you are seeing in your local markets. And with that, I thank you very much. I'd like to introduce Dan Sandry, who's our chief auditor. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bill, and good afternoon, everyone. One thing that Barbara didn't mention is that our auditors have a booth out in the exhibit hall, and you can drop off your business card for a chance to win a great prize. totally kidding. Actually, please do talk to the auditors and deputies. They're great people, and they won't take names unless you ask them to. I have an audit case for you today that demonstrates how a bad decision can override whatever right decision or decisions one may have made before. We'll call this case trust funds. What trust funds? This audit case involved a corporate real estate licensee and began with DRE's receipt of a complaint from a recently hired escrow officer that the former escrow officer of this corporation had embezzled over $300,000 in escrow trust funds over a period of many years. The complainant escrow officer also said that the corporate licensee used two unlicensed fictitious business names in running its broker escrow operations. The allegations of trust fund embezzlement resulted in a DRE audit being requested and assigned quickly. The shares of this corporate licensee were owned evenly by two real estate salespersons. The business activities were property resales and the related broker escrow transactions handled by the corporation. During the 12-month period of May 2006 through April 2007, under the tenure of the former escrow officer, the corporation handled 114 escrows with trust fund receipts of $63 million, so a lot of money was flowing through the accounts. From November 2007 through October 2008, under the tenure of the new escrow officer, the corporation handled 30 escrows with trust fund receipts of $33 million. Much of the reason for the discrepancy in closing numbers between these two periods is that the corporation was winding down operations in 2008. And so we get into the audit. Our auditor found that the corporation maintained three accounts for handling of escrow trust funds. Two were designated as trust accounts, although improperly they were in the name of the unlicensed DBA, and the other, bank account number one, was not designated as a trust account at all. The signers on each of these accounts were the two real estate salesperson owners, the designated officer, and an unlicensed, unbonded escrow officer with just one signature required. So you're saying, uh-oh, right? The audit confirmed the presence of a large trust fund shortage in trust account number one, just as had been complained about. This corporation had serious problems. How large was the shortage, you ask? It was this large. As of March 30th, 2007, there was a shortage of $885,773 due to overdrawn escrows, embezzlement, and a small bank charge. Now, there were two interesting aspects about this case. The first aspect I find to be interesting was the cause of shortage, how the shortage came about. Maybe that's why I am in the business that I am, and why the auditors are in the business they are, is because I find financial crime to be compelling. Usually there is some element of deceit needed to keep the theft of trust funds hidden, and it becomes a puzzle to be solved. The second item of intrigue in this case was the fact that some restitution was exacted from the family of the former escrow officer, and some interesting things happened with that. So let's get into the causes of the shortage. The first cause of the shortage was overdrawn escrows in the amount of $657,350. Much of this related to one transaction which had a negative escrow balance of nearly $562,000, and where funds were dispersed from trust account number 1.5 months before the receipt of over $500,000 that would have covered those disbursements. In doing so, the corporation used funds of beneficiaries in other escrow transactions to cover the costs for a period of a month and a half. And to hide this, the accounting and escrow records indicated that the $500,000 was received before the disbursements were made. But in contrast to what the accounting records say, the bank statements and the deposit slips don't lie. Another negative escrow involved the transfer of funds from multiple escrows to one wherein the former escrow officer and her boyfriend purchased a property in the name of the boyfriend. These transfers of the boyfriend's escrow and other transfers were hidden in accounting records and closing statements by overstating the amount of the seller's payoff to the lender in the HUD 1 closing statements and using the difference to pay for the former escrow officer's expenses. A bit of the shortage was due to a bank charge, and the rest of it was caused by embezzlement by the former escrow officer from trust account number 1 in the amount of $227,708 over a 6-year period via checks and disbursements to herself and other related people and entities. As examples of direct embezzlement from trust account number 1, the former escrow officer made disbursements to herself in the amount of $38,661 and made disbursements to her deceased grandmother in the amount of $82,400. Remarkably, she and her deceased grandmother endorsed the checks. Somehow. There were disbursements to her boyfriend, who, as discussed earlier, also received benefit via an escrow closing. And there were personal mortgage payments made from the trust account, credit card payments, and so on. And we'll call this section the designated officer takes action. By the end of April 2007, most of the negative balances had been made whole by the receipt of the $500,000 for the large escrow. In March or April of 2007, the designated officer discovered the embezzlements by the former escrow officer about one year after signing on as the designated officer. After that, the designated officer and the salesperson owners of the corporation confronted the former escrow officer in a meeting. The designated officer took other steps too. The designated officer fired the former escrow officer and hired a new escrow officer. The designated officer secured the agreement of the corporation owners to allow a full investigation into the embezzlement. The designated officer researched the causes of the shortage and hired a consultant to help identify the causes of the shortage. Furthermore, the designated officer also secured the promise of the former escrow officer's mother in a meeting to pay back $225,000 as restitution for her daughter's misdeeds. The mother did not want her daughter to go to jail. The designated officer also secured the promise of the former escrow officer's boyfriend to pay back $104,000 in restitution. It really seems that this DO is doing pretty good, doesn't it? Alas, it was not to be. So, the designated officer collects cashier's checks of $150,000 and $75,000 from the former escrow officer's mother. And in spite of advice from the consultant and the new escrow officer, and in spite of the promise recorded on audio tape during the meeting with the former escrow officer's mother that the money would be put in a trust account, and in spite of the fact that the shortage due to embezzlement remains in trust account number one, no way, right? You wouldn't do that. The designated officer deposits the $225,000 received from the former escrow officer's mother into the corporation's business expense account and spends it. At a critical decision point, the designated officer fails. By taking the $225,000 and spending it, the designated officer mishandled and used trust funds belonging to the beneficiaries who were victimized in trust account number one by the escrow officer. The trust funds deposited to the general account were spent on office rent, agent commissions, salaries of the owners, the salary of the new escrow officer, the consultant fees, and on the designated officer's fees and salary of over $7,000. The designated officer did not obtain the permission of the owners of the funds to use the money to pay for business expenses. The large shortage of over $220,000 remained. Unfortunately, the corporation's owners later stepped up and corrected the shortage. These events all occurred before the DRE audit was initiated. During the entrance conference of the DRE audit, which was a meeting with the designated officer and the consultant, the designated officer argued with the auditor and argued with the consultant that the $225,000 received from the former escrow officer's mother was not trust funds. The entrance conference, which is normally about a 15 to 30 minute process, took nearly 4 hours. The corporation and designated officer were cited for many violations in the audit, including trust fund shortages, trust fund mishandling, improper account setups and signatories, many record-keeping violations, improper escrow accounting, use of unregistered fictitious business names, and other violations. After an accusation filing and hearing, the license of the corporation and the designated officer were revoked. Incredibly, the designated officer continued to argue unsuccessfully in the hearing and in a writ filed with the Superior Court that the $225,000 received from the escrow officer's mom was not trust funds. Trust funds? What trust funds? The designated officer claimed that he had been treated unfairly, that he had done a lot of good. And he had done some good things up until the point that he took the reimbursed trust funds. So thank you and enjoy the rest of your afternoon in San Jose. And now we bring back Acting Real Estate Commissioner Barbara Bigby.
So this is the question and answer portion of our forum, and we're going to take your questions by panel. So you may direct a question to a particular individual, or you could just fire it off, and we'll fight over it. So if you want to ask us anything, please come up to the mic.
Hi there, Hal Alpert. That's my real name. I'm from Vacaville, and I was very curious about their Renewiski case. I see these signs up all the time around Vacaville and Fairfield and Solano County. We buy homes and, fast sale or something like that. And it always, in my mind, it always looks like a scam. What do we do when we see something like that? I've called, by the way, and not gotten any answer. Maybe because I say I'm a real estate agent.
In essence, I mean, you can call and see who gets who actually is placing those ads. But, you know, it essentially is what they're doing is they're trolling for distressed sellers. So, you know, you might even report it to us and maybe we can make a call and see what kind of activity is taking place with those operations. Some of them may be legitimate, but, you know, they're obviously looking for bargain prices on real estate from individuals who have to sell. And these people are in a vulnerable position.
Is there a specific number that we should call and say, you might want to check this, or?
You can check with, our numbers are posted on our website with the district office closest to you, which I, you said you were from where?
Vacaville?
Yeah.
So that would be our Sacramento office.
Okay, thanks.
Hi there, Lisa Crosby Torres. I'm from Danville. I'm a managing broker of an office. We're seeing a practice related to a bulletin you guys put out in September of last year relating to the short sales and listing brokers requiring that the buyers or the buyer's agents pay negotiators' fees. There seems to still be a lot of confusion in the marketplace. It doesn't seem that most of the brokers will follow the advice that's been put out in that alert, and we have a lot of arguments with our agents that it's absolutely proper as long as it's shown on the HUD one and that the buyer can pay it as long as they agree to. And I'd like to ask your opinion and if you plan on doing any further communication with the brokerage public on that.
I'm not certain whether we're going to do another alert on this subject. We hear that the short sales fraud continues to grow and evolve, and we get reports weekly about what we're seeing out there in the real world. Our position has evolved a bit as well. If a short sale negotiator is licensed, if they're actually adding value, if there is full disclosure, nothing hidden, the lenders are aware of it and everybody else is aware of it, we see no problem in paying that fee. Where we have a problem, and I think everyone in this room would have a problem, is where the fee is basically a junk fee. Someone is required to pay to some entity, whether licensed or unlicensed, and that person or entity does absolutely nothing. And it's just a way to get more money into someone's pockets when there is absolutely nothing valuable provided by that negotiator. But we do know that in some circumstances, there are folks out there who do specialize in short sales. That's all they do, and they may have some extra special abilities to negotiate. I'm not certain of that, but you know that's what some folks claim. And so, to the extent that there's disclosure, they're licensed, they add value, and everybody knows about it, there's not a problem from our perspective.
And no problem then in asking the buyer to pay for it.
No, if there's something that's provided and there's licensed activity and everybody knows about it, no problem.
Okay, great. I think it'd be nice to have that updated because I think that September piece that was put out was extremely confusing, and I think it's really led a lot of confusion in the brokerage community because it said that if it wasn't put forward to the lender up front and it merely showed up on the HUD one, it could be considered loan fraud. So we've got a lot of confusion amongst our brokers.
Thank you.
I would just add to that that if the fee is paid in advance to a licensed entity, then obviously they have to have the advance fee agreement on file with the Department of Real Estate. And beyond that, the buyer can pay the fee as long as it's disclosed as to where the fee is coming from.
Hi, Melinda Hoff, Calaveras County. Today we heard a lot about big fraud schemes and unlicensed realtors. What about realtors themselves, the onesie twosies? We're to be the eyes and ears, but in talking just in the last 48 hours being here, there's not many that don't have their own story to tell, but yet it's really hard to call and turn in your next door neighbor.
Right.
When you live in small communities. Has there been any thought to a hotline on fraud that's going, I'm speaking of arm's length, short sales that are not arm's length transactions, that sort of stuff. I mean, I know we should be the eyes and ears. I don't feel that we're ever going to recover unless us as a group take part in this, but yet you're almost pushing yourself out there in a corner doing so at this point because you have to come so forward to report someone in your own industry.
We do actually accept anonymous complaints, but they should be documented well enough that, you know, we can see that there's an actual problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we do look into that. Also, we have an advocacy program that can be utilized in some of these cases where if it's you're in the middle of a transaction and someone's demanding a fee that is unlawful, if you report it to us, we can handle it as an advocacy matter, contact the broker as well as the agent on the other side of the transaction, and just let them know that we're aware of the issue and we're aware of what's going on in the transaction. A lot of times that can help stop it. Because, you know, they're not going to proceed with a transaction when they know that our eyes are on it.
Yeah, I understand. Another thing, too, then, when you can confront someone and they will tell you, oh, it's okay, we did our investigation and it was okay with the bank. Well, it's not in my office. I'm not a party to the transaction. But as far as I know, I don't know of a bank taking a not at arm's length transaction now. Everyone generally has to sign an affidavit of arm's length. But when another agent that you know is telling you, oh, but the bank said it's okay, I don't have any way to prove otherwise, but I feel that there's fraud going on. I mean, does anyone here know of not at arm's length short sales happening?
I'm not aware of that.
I'm just questioning. I haven't heard of that.
And as you say, most of the lenders now have that arm's length affidavit.
Affidavit, correct. So, okay, thank you.
Yeah. And just as a follow-up to what Bill said, we understand folks' reluctance to come forward and say, I know this person who's engaged in fraud or may be engaged in fraud. And to the extent that you do have the facts, you do have particular knowledge about a transaction where there's wrongdoing, if you can give us whatever information you have so we can do an independent investigation. But in the absence of a live witness, facts, and evidence, we can't do anything, and nor can any of the civil or criminal prosecutors. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Carol McCoy from Merced, California. Something is coming up, and I'm not sure whether this is the latest fraud going on. I planned on bringing it to my district attorney when I get home from meetings, but I'm right here, so let me ask all of you. I had a client who was an investor. We went to the courthouse sale. His home was foreclosed upon. He got home, he called me, and within 2 hours, he was getting calls. And I've got the telephone numbers, and he actually recorded a couple of the calls, so I've got those. One was from a 603 area code, which is New Hampshire, saying we understand your home was just foreclosed upon. The bank may have done this in error. There may be some way of us going back and keeping your home. If you want to talk to us, please hit button 1 now. The second one was, if you're in your home and we understand it's just been foreclosed upon, we may be able to help you stay in it for 6 to 9 months. So please call us back at this number. I've never heard this before, and it was honest to God, within 2 hours of that foreclosure taking place in Merced, one of the calls was from Southern California, one was from New Hampshire, and I don't remember where the third one, but they were bing, 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 and I'm thinking, this sounds like fraud to me. Have you guys heard of any of this?
The timing's very bizarre that it's so quick, right after the foreclosure.
2 hours,
but
yeah.
But we've heard similar schemes to this, and so much of it's just the trolling of what they're called lead generators, and many of them are lead generators for lawyers. And what they basically do is they say, we think we can save your home. The bank may have done something improperly through robo-signing, or they haven't followed their own rules.
Yeah.
And we can get you signed up with a lawyer who's about to file a lawsuit, or who's your lender? Now, we've got a lawsuit, or we're thinking about a lawsuit, and all you have to do is pay us some several thousand dollars, and then we'll take care of this for you. The information you have, I would love it if you'd share it with Bill or with
I'm
me.
I'm more than happy.
Because we're sending this sort of stuff to the AG's office, because they have a fraud task force, as well as to the state bar, and they're looking at Barbara mentioned the term, they're called mass joinder cases. And what these lawyers are doing is they're saying, we have begun the lawsuit process, or we're thinking about doing a lawsuit against Chase or Bank of America or whatever entity it is. And they say, if you pay us $3,000 or $2,000 or whatever the amount is, you can get involved in this lawsuit and you can get your home for free, or you can get a reduction of your principal, or you can get some other magic thing that may or may not happen. But they're just generating leads for people who are then going to make the sale, that you give us money in advance and we're going to help you.
I will get someone's card
before you leave and
do this, because I told my client, this sounds like fraud where they're asking for money again and you've already lost the home. Don't do it. For God's sakes, don't do it.
If you want to just have an eye-opening or spine-chilling experience, go on the internet and type in foreclosure rescue or save my home or how I save my home, and you'll see all of these ads.
Thank you very much.
I'm just curious what on one of those scams you were talking about, flash funds or flesh funds or something. I don't understand what that is.
Yeah, there are companies out there, and they're all over the country, that in essence what they do is they just provide ready funding for the first leg of double escrow transactions. And their expectation is that they've supplied the initial funding, the property is in double escrow, there's a legitimate loan, and they're paid back. And they're trying to earn a high rate of interest and a short turnaround time on their monies. The company I referred to was based in the state of Washington. And a lot of them, again, they're all over the country, but that's all they do is they provide funding. And what they expect is that there's going to be a quick turnaround of those monies. They'll be paid back with a handsome interest on it.
So when the second escrow closes, how do they lose their money then?
Well, when the second escrow closes, they don't lose their money. But when all of a sudden the scheme turns to where they're not using those funds for even the initial purchase, but instead just absconding with them, that's how they ended up losing their money.
Oh, okay.
That particular case went along, or a company went along for months, actually completing a lot of these transactions and probably getting everyone comfortable with their operation, and then all of a sudden things changed. And underlying encumbrances weren't paid off, and all the flash funds were absconded.
And monies were taken out of the escrow.
And the second escrow never closed. And
right.
Exactly.
And I'm not certain what the ultimate number is going to be, but we're talking about many millions of dollars.
We're thinking about $17 million on that case.
Wow. Okay.
Hi, my name is Dave Walsh. I'm frustrated. I work this community. Vic Foe was in our community. He was a member of our association. I don't claim credit for this, but I first brought Vic Foe to Mr. Davi's attention in 2006. Mm-hmm. At a function and said, look, there's a problem here. You need to investigate this gentleman. This is now 2011 and the conviction happened. And I realize the wheels of justice are really slow. And you know the details behind Vic, but there's a whole side of our valley that was devastated by his company. The amount of fraud that, you know, that your presentation showed is, as you know, just the tip of the iceberg with what we could probably prove Mr. Foe was involved with. At the end of the day, it took 5-6 years to nail him, I guess, if that's an appropriate word. The problem is that, you know, there's just so much of it. It was everywhere, and his tentacles were involved in so many transactions. You know, we even got sued as an association. We got sued this year because we kicked him out of our association. You know, he sued to be readmitted to our association. You know, this is a problem. And then I read the DRE release, or the press release, and it's a cute little paragraph. And maybe you can't talk a lot about this, but this should be all over the news. This should be a major, huge story or press release or something, because the people that preyed on the disadvantaged in the Latino community and the Vietnamese community of our valley, they don't know any of this stuff, and they're not going to read it. They're not going to read a DRE press release. You know, is there more coming? Is there going to be billboards out someplace? Any kind of...
let me respond if I can. We are as frustrated as you are. We go to press conferences, we do press releases, we talk with local media, and no one seems to pick this up. We are almost at wit's end. We have limited remedies. The most we can do against someone like Big Foe is take his license away. Prosecutors need to do something. They're overwhelmed. They're, just so you know, a standard of proof, civil case preponderance of the evidence, ours is higher against a licensee, clear and convincing evidence to reasonable certainty. And we've got to have evidence, we've got to have witnesses, we've got to have documents. And putting out a case is time consuming, and then you have an administrative law judge that looks at it, writes an opinion, and our commissioner can accept or not accept the proposed decision. Sometimes we send it back for additional evidentiary hearings, and then we put on another part of case. Sometimes it goes up to a superior court. It can go to the Court of Appeal, the California Supreme Court. It's a very time-consuming process. There's a piece of legislation that's out there now, and I forget whether it's SB 53 or SB 706, but it will permit us to go public when we think that there's great public harm. And that's going to help a lot.
Yeah.
Because there's so many folks, I have to say, I can't give you names, but there's so many folks we're investigating. I would like to have it on my car. Don't talk to these people. They're thieves. Don't use them.
Yeah.
And I know we all would, but we can't do that because we have to keep our investigations confidential. And the criminal prosecution process is so slow. You know, it lags way behind the fraud that's taking place. In fact, if you look at the newspaper reports of fraud out there, you'll see they're prosecuting fraud that took place in the good times. It was the origination fraud. They're just now starting to look at the fraud we have. And they have a much steeper burden. They've got to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And in one case where I talked to the prosecutor in Sacramento, they had 8 defendants. A number of them were licensed. Every defendant said, I want my own jury trial. And they brought in very good, very competent criminal defense attorneys. So it's a slow, frustrating process. And we, if you have some idea for us as to how we can get information out better than we are, I would love to hear it. But we do the press releases. We send information out through our agency, the Business Transportation Housing Agency. We get approval through the governor's office. They want this information out there. The public should have this information, but we can't force the media to take information that they're just not interested in. And we're sort of doing everything we can think of to do exactly what you want to do.
Right. Do you know if have there actually been any convictions from the DA side against Mr. Foe? Was it just, I mean, I understand your ability to pull his license.
There's been none against Big Foe to date. I mean, the only one that I know has been prosecuted is Gloria Alvarez that I spoke about.
Yeah.
But I will say, you know, that particular case was just fraught with problems from our end. There were forgeries on loan applications all over. But the interesting thing is who took the loan application? A loan application would be in the name of a specific salesperson or acting as a loan representative. And we start asking questions, well, I didn't sign that. So you take a look at the loan app signature of their name and look at our licensing applications of their name, and they didn't sign that. It was like everyone was forging everyone else's name. Big Foe was way up at the top of this and not actually involved in the nuts and bolts of a lot of these transactions. Then we had a further issue of all the lenders basically dispersing and the loan files being in places that, you know, frankly took us a long time to find. Our action in that case was in question for quite some time. Yeah. We were finally able to pull it together. So, I mean, I do apologize. That took a long time. But, you know, we did really make our best effort.
Well, I guess two things. A good thing is you ultimately pulled his license, which is, I guess, a major step in the right direction. You know, we sat in, serving on professional standards and past president of our association, et cetera, I sat in all these hearings, not necessarily hearings, but just the clients that they took advantage of would come in and pour their hearts out to us. And there's some tremendous stories. And as you all know, you all have in your own communities. And this was just a travesty. If there's any silver lining to the economic downturn, is the fact that Big Foe made less money in the last few years than he could have made with if the real estate market had stayed red hot in Silicon Valley. You know, so I mean, it was astounding how many little fingers he had in virtually every pie. And the truth was, he had appraisal companies, he had termite companies, he had everything. The list of charges you put on that $45,000 you got from that one escrow, that didn't count the fraudulent termite reports that we had that we saw and the claims for repairs, etc. It's just it's a travesty. And so I'm glad he's gone. In theory.
Okay.
My name's Cecil Volch. I have a question for you. I have a client that I'm representing now buying a property, and he has a mobile home in a park that he's selling. Is that something that falls under your jurisdiction? The mobile home sale?
If the mobile home is affixed to real property, then, yeah, it's considered real property.
If it's not, then...
It's considered personal property, and then is it HCD or DMV?
Yeah, it's housing and community development.
Yeah. Okay, because, I mean, the situation, he's got it listed. The agent's not doing anything to help him sell it. It's just terrible. Not listed, not multiple listing. Probably worth $25,000. He charged him $6,000 in commission. I mean, it's just incredible. And he's done nothing. He hasn't advertised it. So I just wanted to, the housing, urban, or is it?
Yeah, it's the California Department of Housing and Community Development.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Jim Keith, Region 11, Ventura County. I share some of the frustration. I know, Bill, you're aware of that it takes a long time. But when it's mortgage fraud, there's going to be a paper trail, and it takes time to build that trail. But when the FBI or whoever does indict, they're going to have a darn strong case. That's one frustration. The other one I have, this is my 37th year in the real estate business. I've been in professional standards for 34. When I hear realtors saying that they're reluctant to file complaints, that really irritates me. You know, we are in a business that is supposed to police itself. There are people in our business that don't belong in our business. And everything that everybody in this room does reflects upon me. Everything I do reflects upon them. You know, it's time that we took a stand everywhere and got rid of the bad actors.
Thank you.
Anything else? Any other questions? Comments? Cheap shots, that's not fair. All right, then, we're adjourned. Thank you for coming.